she said, as if the two ideas couldn't possibly exist without each other. My father came from an old intellectual family, and Mama from a young bohemian one. Neither viewed organized religion with uncritical awe. It was one of the few common territories between them. After my birth, nobody thought of baptizing me. When I asked about God, aged 8, mind you, Daddy told me solemnly that I should believe whatever my conscience held to be true. I asked him, what was a conscience? He said it was my inner voice that told me right from wrong, and from then on, when I thought of God at all, I thought of old Grandmama Schuyler, because for some reason her voice shrilled inside my head whenever I faced any kind of moral crisis. Don't you take that second cookie, or let the adults speak for a change, and that kind of thing. At the moment, and in her present condition, Isabel Fisher did bear an uncommon resemblance to Grandmama Schuyler, who was also long-boned and lean, and whose hair had been blonde before it turned a rusty, streaked silver. I hadn't seen my stepsister since the previous night, when she'd stumbled onto dry land, vomited over the grass, and staggered into the house under Joseph's protection. His arm had held her shoulder, and his face wore an expression of stern pity, mixed with maybe a little remorse. He must have cleaned her up and put her to bed, but you could still read the history of the night before in that wan, tanned skin, in that dull hair, in those lavender half-moons beneath her eyes, which squinted against the sunshine. She wore an immaculate suit of dandelion yellow and a pair of matching shoes, and one hand rested against the doorframe to hold the whole act upright. The other hand contained her white gloves and pocketbook. "What time does it start?" I asked feebly. 8:30, she glanced at her watch. "You'd better hurry. I'll get the car." 11. "The thing is, everybody goes," Isabel called above the roar of the engine as we hurtled down the road toward St. Anne's Episcopal Church at the eastern end of the island. "If you don't turn up, they'll wonder why." "I don't care about that," I called back. "You will, believe me." She drove wantonly, wastefully, rushing down the straight stretches and then slamming the brakes into the curves so that the tires of her father's sleek Plymouth convertible whined and slid against the faded asphalt. All the while, she clutched a cigarette between the first two fingers of her right hand, and along the straightaways, she sucked long currents of smoke between her clenched red lips. I kept my hands fixed in my lap. The sun packed its heat into the car's interior. Isabel had put the top up in order to save our good hats from the draft, and my flesh still glowed from the haste of getting dressed. Underneath the suit and blouse, a trickle of perspiration ran down my left armpit and along my side. The smell of hot leather and cigarettes made me want to vomit. By the time we reached the neat white church, sitting against a field of green and surrounded by cars, I'd begun to feel faint for the first time since that terrible flu in my freshman year at Foxcroft. Isabel slammed to a stop in the grass, and I threw open the door to inhale the clean, green-smelling air. The swollen cords of an organ billowed past. "Damn it all to hell and back again!" Isabel threw her cigarette into the grass and stomped it with her toe. "We're late!" We ran across the meadow, holding hands, weaving between cars until we reached the wooden steps of the church, and slowed to a reverent pace. Isabel turned in the vestibule and ripped off her glove to fix my hat. By some strange trick of the sunlight, her engagement ring threw a shower of glitter on the wall just above the altar, and all the inhabitants of the packed pews started and turned, searching for the source of this otherworldly fireworks. They found us soon enough. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, a church full of well-dressed strangers all staring at you in astonished disapproval. I don't recommend it. Sometimes in my nightmares, the image of those faces still returns to me. Except I'm naked and grossly pregnant, and Isabel's left me to face them all alone, instead of clutching my hand in a firm grip, as she did then, and leading me to a pew in the last row, wedged up against the side aisle. The organ tootled on from above, oblivious, and the faces turned away one by one because the singing was about to start and none of those great ladies wanted to miss her cue. On Winthrop Island, as I learned, the singing of hymns was a competitive exercise, preferably in a high, godly soprano to reach heaven itself and, coincidentally, drown out the efforts of both your neighbor and the choir in the small balcony above. The choir, you understand, had room for just 10 members, filled by a ritual of cordial, bitterly contested auditions at the beginning of each summer season. As for the men, I don't know. I don't think they cared as much. Even so innocent as I then was, I noticed how they kept slipping impious glances at Isabel and me, young and animal, glowing with perspiration in our shapely pastel suits. That space of ours at the end of the pew had lain empty for a good reason, because it stood square in the path of a block of sunlight, and as Isabel flipped hastily through the hymnal, I found myself gasping for air once more. The notes and words swam before me. The hymn ended, the blessing began, the congregational responses, and at last, we lowered ourselves to the hard wooden bench and allowed the service to swallow us. 12. Afterward, the congregation gathered in the churchyard and greeted each other in the hot sun. Everybody was so nice. Said such pleasant, vague things about my mother and the wedding yesterday, how they wished Mr. and Mrs. Fisher all the happiness in the world, such a beautiful couple. I realized I must have been entirely mistaken about those hostile expressions at the beginning of the service. Mrs. Monk invited us over for bridge. "Of course," said Isabel, kissing her cheek, "I'll drive Miranda." Clay regarded Isabel with a slight frown.
"I'd be happy to drive."
"But we'll be all squished in front, and I won't have Miranda in back all by herself."
"She wouldn't mind, would you, Miranda?"
A word or two about Clayton Monk, as he aimed a respectful pair of eyes at me and awaited my reply. At the time, I thought he was too good for Isabel. Not too handsome and dashing and rich, I mean, but too good. She was probably going to ruin him. I thought he had no natural defense against her, no edge at all. I mean, just look at him as he then was, made of pleasant, bland good looks that would inevitably grow red and jowly in middle age, but not before he'd passed them on to a pair of sons, whom he taught to sail. I could picture them all, father and sons in sailboat. He wore a double-breasted navy jacket and tan slacks, a white shirt with a crisp collar, a sedate silk tie the color of hydrangeas. Looking at him, you wouldn't imagine that he'd once spent his days crisscrossing Europe in a B-17 flying fortress, dropping bombs all over the place, and that on a nice summer midnight in 1944 he'd crashed said flying fortress into a French field so expertly that only one man was killed, and Clay himself had gotten away with a broken arm and a concussion. Afterward, as I said, he went to Harvard, and then Harvard Law School, and he now occupied an office in some blue-blood law firm or another, working his way toward the partnership, one dry, passive sentence at a time. Which might sound boring to you and me, but at least he was doing something, wasn't he? Earning his own living instead of idling his days atop the Monk department store fortune. Anyway, in the summer of 1951, Clayton Monk was all that was pink and well-scrubbed. Just looking at him made you feel clean inside and out, like a wholesome breakfast cereal. I smiled back and said, "I don't mind a little squishing. My skirt's all creased anyway." 13. On the way to the Monk Estate, which was perched near the eastern tip of the island, right next to the Winthrop Island Club and exactly opposite to Greyfriars, I asked Isabel whether she'd seen Joseph at church. Because I hadn't. There was a little silence.
"Joseph," said Clayton, who was driving. "Joseph who?"
Isabel said quickly,
"Don't be silly, Peaches, of course not."
"Didn't you say everybody goes to church on the island?" She started to laugh.
"Darling, he goes to St. Mary's in the village, the Catholic church."
"Oh, Joseph Vargas," said Clayton. I didn't realize you'd met the locals yet.
Yesterday morning, he brought in another lobsterman who'd fallen overboard, and then last night, Isabel's elbow met my ribs.
What about last night? Asked Clay.
Nothing. I looked out the window toward the sea. Of course, the Catholic Church. I didn't think.
Isabel sat between us on the front seat, tilting her long legs at an acute angle to fit them under the dashboard.
Clayton, a tall man, had taken down the top, and the draft blew warmly over our hats and ears.
Isabel rummaged in her pocketbook for a cigarette and lit it clumsily.
"Here's a funny thing about the island, Peaches," she said, as she tried to get the lighter going in the middle of the crosswind. "I think it's telling. The Episcopal Church only opens during the summer season, see, May to September, while the Catholic Church runs all year round. Don't you think that's telling, Clay?"
"Telling what, darling?"
"I mean the way things work around the island. Who does what and where and when?"
Clay propped his elbow on the doorframe and tilted his head to one side so he could rub his left eyebrow. His right hand gripped the wheel at 12 o'clock.
"I don't know what you're trying to say, Izzy. Sure, most of the fishermen happen to be Portuguese around here. Portuguese folks happen to be mostly Catholic."
"Exactly."
"Well, you're trying to make out like it's some kind of crime, that's all."
"It's not a crime," she said.
She'd finally succeeded in lighting her cigarette, and she now smoked it with a peculiar ferocity.
"Well, we all get along, don't we? They've got their religion, and we've got ours."
"And never the twain shall meet," Isabel said softly.
"And everybody respects each other. Nobody's got a thing against Catholics around here."
I spoke up timidly. "I think what Isabel's trying to say is that the summer residents, the ones with all the power and the money..."
"All right," Clay said. "All right, fine. Look, it's a Sunday. Let's stay away from politics for one day, okay?"
He straightened and reached for the radio dial. Isabel, looking out the side, past my nose toward the blurry meadows, the occasional house, said,
"Have you noticed there aren't any trees, Peaches? Old native ones, I mean?
Now that you mention it,
it's because of some hurricane."
She sucked on her cigarette.
"Some hurricane over 100 years ago that flattened everything. Now the island's like a Scottish moor or something. Or Ireland, one of those. Isn't that right, Clay?"
"I guess so."
He was still working the radio dial.
"Do you get any stations out here?" I asked.
"We get a couple out of Providence, when the wind's right. Sometimes Boston."
He turned the dial millimeter by millimeter, listening carefully to the pattern of static.
"Oh, why bother?" said Isabel. "Honestly, we're almost there."
I waved away a stream of smoke. "This might be a good time to mention that I don't play bridge."
"What's that?" said Clay.
"She doesn't play bridge," Isabel shouted in his ear.
"Not play bridge? But I thought all you girls played bridge."
"Miranda doesn't. She's an intellectual. Did you know she was named after a girl in Shakespeare?"
"Is that so? Now that's grand. Which one? Which play, I mean?"
Isabel turned to me.
"Which one, Peaches?"
"The Tempest," I said, just as the car slowed and began its turn down a long, slender, curving drive toward a house plucked right out of the half-timbered Elizabethan countryside and onto a cliff overlooking the entrance to Long Island Sound. At that instant, whether by design or coincidence, a bank of black clouds swallowed up the sun. 14. When it comes to bridge, the punishment for ignorance is apparently banishment, which suited me well enough. For a short while I hung around the well-appointed drawing room, holding my iced tea, watching the rain shatter violently against the French windows while the monks, unconcerned, set up the bridge table. Lucky for them, or again, maybe by design, there were two other guests, a mother and daughter, who made up the other sides. They were the Huxleys, Mrs. Huxley and her daughter Livy. And Isabel explained that it was Dr. Huxley, husband and father of same, who had come to Popeye's rescue in the Fisher kitchen yesterday. We exchanged the usual bland pleasantries. Livy and her mother were perfectly nice, perfectly pretty, like two round, full scoops of vanilla ice cream, the younger one wearing a dress like a lemon meringue. I remember thinking at the time how utterly harmless they seemed, how absent of tooth and claw. Clay had disappeared somewhere with his father. Isabel had mixed herself a drink from the liquor cabinet and now sat in her bridge chair next to Mrs. Monk, wearing an expression of shark-like intensity. When the rain died away to a drizzle, I called over my shoulder that I was going for a walk to see the cliffs, and I slipped through one of the French doors to the bluestone terrace and the lawn beyond. The wet grass soaked my shoes and stockings. When I reached the cliff's edge, I took them off and laid the stockings to dry across a large white rock, and then I sat down on a neighboring rock and watched the clouds storm angrily away to the northeast. The cliffs weren't especially high, maybe 40 or 50 feet, but they were steep and rugged, and the path snaked carefully down the least forbidding side to end in a pale beach. Out to sea, a lone sailboat picked its way along the coast, about 100 yards from shore. Now that the sun shone unobstructed, the heat built once more, sinking into my skin and bones and the rough surface of the rock beneath me. I removed my jacket. I'd left my hat and gloves indoors, and thought I should really find some shade before I burned. But I didn't want to move. There was just enough breeze to make it bearable. The air was rich and damp with the smell of the sea, and there was something hypnotic about the movements of that lone, brave sailboat, something graceful and eternal. I could just make out the man who sat in the stern, next to the tiller. He had dark hair that flashed from time to time against the white of the triangular sail, and at some point, as I watched, I began to realize that the sailor was Joseph. Or maybe I was only hoping it was Joseph. Maybe it was just longing. I straightened and squinted, and as if he felt my scrutiny, the sailor turned his head toward shore. Joseph. I raised my hand and waved, even though he couldn't possibly recognize me from there, not sitting, as I was, on the opposite corner of the island from the house where I was supposed to be sitting. Up went Joseph's arm, returning the wave, and then he rose from his seat at the tiller and reached for a rope, a sheet. Wasn't that what they called ropes on boats? Sort of confusing, if you ask me, because something you called a sheet ought logically to be a sail. Whatever it was, Joseph did something to it, adjusting its pitch against the wind. When he turned back, his arm lifted again, in such a way that he seemed to be beckoning me toward the water. I stood and glanced at my shoes and stockings, drying on the nearby rock. I glanced at the path, snaking its way to the beach below. My skin was flushed and damp, my skirt creased, my blouse stained with perspiration. The salt breeze tumbled my hair.
"Miranda, there you are!"
I pitched forward. Clayton's arm shot out to catch me.
"Careful,"
he said. "Sorry, I didn't hear you come up."
"No need to apologize. Shouldn't have snuck up like that. Gosh, who's that crazy fellow out there?"
"Just some sailboat," I said.
"He's not afraid of a little squall, I guess."
Clay stuck his hands in his trouser pockets. He'd taken off his jacket and stood there in his shirt sleeves, rolled halfway up his forearms. A considerable concession to the heat for a man like him. He rolled onto his toes and back down again.
"Say, do you have a moment, Miranda?"
he asked. "Sure I do."
"Can we sit?"
I took the larger rock next to my shoes and stockings while Clay propped himself on the smaller one and crossed his legs at the ankles. His feet looked hot and uncomfortable, encased in brown argyle socks and leather shoes. I tucked my bare white toes against the rock and said, "Anything in particular?"
"Actually," he said, as if the idea had just occurred to him, "I wanted to ask you about Izzy."
"What about Izzy?" He uncrossed his ankles and crossed them again, putting the other foot on top. His hands twiddled together against his thighs.
"That was some party yesterday, wasn't it? A big day for you both. A happy day. We're all... well, we couldn't be happier for Mr. Fisher. Your mother's everything we might have hoped for in a new mother for Izzy.
She's already got a mother, hasn't she?
Well, of course, that depends on whom you ask. I don't like to speak ill of people. You haven't met her, have you? The ex-Mrs. Fisher?
No.
I don't suppose there's any reason you should. She lives in... is it Nice? Somewhere in the south of France, I understand. She remarried a few years ago. Some old French aristocrat she met during the war. Lost all his dough, I guess, and wanted hers. They say he's...
A what?
Nothing. Nothing you need to know about. Let's just say they both go their own ways, the two of them. That's what I hear, anyway.
Then why did they marry?
People marry for all kinds of reasons, Miranda. I don't know, maybe she wanted the title. She's a funny old bird. Always was. Restless, you know. Wanted to go abroad all the time, spend her time with that international set. You know who I mean. Instead of summering on the island.
At the time, I didn't know whom he meant. Clay pronounced the words international set with distaste, as if it were some disease that had no cure. But to me it sounded exotic and wonderful. So I said innocently, what's wrong with that? I'd like to go abroad.
I mean make a habit of it. Socialize with those people. Artists and aristocrats and hangers-on. New money. All the time having affairs and divorcing and God knows what else. Anyway, she's never shown much interest in poor Izzy, even when she was a baby. So I think we were all hoping, when we heard the news, and then we met you and your mother.
Maybe she'd be an improvement?
He nodded vigorously. Oh, she is. I mean, you've got to be careful what you say, because Mrs. Fisher, the former Mrs. Fisher, I mean, the Countess, whatever she is now, her family still summers here. The Dumonts?
The end of the sentence turned up inquisitively, as if there were some kind of chance I knew the Dumonts personally. I've heard about them, I said. Before us, the sailboat had started another tack. The sun caught the brilliant white of the canvas, so sharp against the dark blue sea that I had to look away.
Anyway, that's all behind us now, said Clay. What's important is that Izzy has someone to look out for her now.
You're her fiancé. Aren't you supposed to be doing that?
But we won't be married until next June.
He sprang from the rock and stepped forward, right to the edge of the cliff. He had a nice trim backside, a narrow waist. A pair of old-fashioned braces held up his trousers.
Last night, he said.
I waited a moment and said, what about last night?
I don't know what happened with you two. Maybe I don't want to know. She had a little too much to drink, didn't she? She gets carried away, you see.
He seemed to be starting another sentence, which he bit off. I had the feeling he was struggling with something, groping, juggling words in his head. He fiddled with his sleeves, took out his handkerchief, wiped away the perspiration on his temples. For what it's worth, I like that about her, I said. I like her high spirits.
Yes, of course. Look, I don't know. I don't usually... Miranda, you don't mind me calling you that?
Of course not.
Do you mind if I tell you something private, just between you and me, Miranda? Because I can tell you aren't the gossiping type.
You can tell me whatever you like, Mr. Monk.
Clay. Look, the truth is, the night before the wedding, we'd had a bit of a... I don't know what to call it.
Clay, you don't...
A lover's quarrel.
The words burst out almost in a shout. Lover's quarrel. Followed by a delicate silence expecting my reply. When I didn't say anything, Clay looked down and toed the dirt.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I haven't told anyone, not even Mother.
You've got to talk to someone, don't you? You can't keep everything bottled inside.
Clay made a dry noise. Can't I? That's what we do, Miranda. Keep it all bottled. Don't burden anybody with your private troubles. We don't talk, certainly not to strangers. I sometimes wish...
He let the sentence dangle, the wish unexpressed. I tucked my legs against my chest and wrapped my arms around them. A few feet away, Clayton shifted his feet and noticed the handkerchief in his hand. He shoved it back in his pocket. I said, "If there's anything I can do to help." It was as if I'd pulled the cork from his mouth. Clayton started to burble.
"She's a terrific girl, Izzy. She's the one. I mean, there's never been anyone else. But she's got a restless streak. Always has. All this bottled-up energy like some kind of 4th of July firework. Don't get me wrong. It's one of the things I love about her. Maybe she gets it from her mother. I don't know. You just can't take your eyes off her, wondering what crazy, wonderful thing she's going to do next."
I pressed my thumbs together. I think I was trying not to say something rash, trying to hold back this immense surge of pity I felt for Clayton Monk in that moment. He leaned down and picked up a rock from the dirt near his feet, turned that rock around again and again between his fingers, examining every last ridge, every facet, each tiny grain that made up the whole. He went on in a quiet voice, talking not to me but to the rock in his hand.
"The trouble is, she gets temperamental. She gets in these moods sometimes, and I just I don't know what to do. Honestly, I don't know what I said the other night. I mean, I don't have the slightest clue what upset her so much."
Clay dropped the rock suddenly and put his hand to the back of his neck. His fingers were long, his nails well-trimmed, his forearm dusted with light hair. His other hand sat on his hip. I looked past him toward the sea, but his body now blocked my view of Joseph in his sailboat, and I didn't want to rise and startle him, so close as he stood to the edge of the cliff. I said, "It was probably just the excitement of the day. She loves you very much."
"Does she? Did she say that?"
"Well, not in so many words." He made a mournful laugh.
"Thanks for the honesty."
I didn't know what to say. I hardly knew him at all, him or Isabel. I had the feeling I'd walked onto the stage of a play sometime in the middle of the second act and assumed a leading role. And I had no script, no story. I didn't even know the name of this play. Was probably wearing the wrong costume. I leaned back on my hands and stared at the long vertical creases down the back of Clay's shirt. The sun burned the top of my head, my hands, the back of my neck. A gull screamed from the rocks down below.
"Vargas," Clay exclaimed.
I startled up. "What? Where?"
"The lighthouse keeper's son. Fellow who was with you last night. Don't deny it. Vargas?"
"Joseph. Yes."
"I think he's in love with her."
The sentence struck in the middle of my chest. I stepped to one side, in order to find Joseph's sailboat on the stretch of empty sea before us. For a second or two, I thought he'd been swallowed by the water, but when I shielded my eyes and looked farther, I saw he had only angled around the eastern tip of the island to tack down the other side. The boat was smaller now. You couldn't make out Joseph himself, just the white triangular sail against the navy water, as it began to disappear behind the land's edge. I caught my breath again and said, "How do you know?"
"Oh, he's always been crazy about her. Used to hang around the house when they were small, take the dinghy back and forth. They had some kind of signal they used to send each other through the windows."
"But she doesn't feel the same way. She's engaged to you, not to him."
"Another man's ring isn't going to stop a fellow like that."
"I don't think..." I checked myself.
"Don't think what?"
"I just think he's more honorable than that."
"Do you? Well, I've known him all my life, and I wouldn't put it past him. Not the way he's been pining for her all these years. Sitting there in his lighthouse, watching her from the window, beckoning her over to see him."
The tip of the sail winked out past the edge of the cliff. "Then Isabel should put a stop to it," I said, "especially if it hurts you."
"Oh, it doesn't hurt me. Not a bit. A fellow like that."
Clay turned to face me, and his expression was so haggard, the lines so deep and painful in his fresh young face, I forgot my anger. He took my shoulder under his hand.
"It's Izzy I'm worried about. She's impulsive. She trusts him, God knows why. It's because he's not one of us. He's... well, she knows she can't marry him. And you know how it is with girls."
He broke off and, perhaps realizing how tightly he was gripping my shoulder, let his hand drop to his side, where he shoved it into his pocket.
And he loves her. He's crazy about her. Last night I should have... Man, I should have gone over there myself. I should have socked him. If I'd known, I would have.
I'm glad you didn't. Nothing happened, Clay, nothing at all. She was... We were both a little tipsy from the champagne and all, and he was worried about us and rode us back home. That's all. Joseph did a good thing.
He could have telephoned me. I would have fetched her back.
Do they have a telephone out there?
Sure they do. Underground cable.
I didn't realize.
There's a lot you don't realize.
He swiveled back to the sea, ran a hand through his hair and shoved it in his pocket like the other hand, good and deep.
Mr. Fisher, God bless him, he's indulged her all these years. I don't blame him. She's had it tough with that mother of hers and, well, and everything else. But he's not here to protect her just now. And I hope... I don't mean to ask you to sneak around for me, nothing like that, but I just... If you could let me know if she's in trouble, that's all. If she's about to do something stupid.
I pictured that engagement ring, 3 or 4 carats dangling above the sapphire water. She's not going to do anything stupid, I said. And if she is, I don't think I could stop her.
I could. I could stop her. If you just let me know how she's doing, what she's doing.
He pulled his left hand out of the pocket and checked his watch.
I've got to be back at the firm tomorrow, but I'll be back up here as often as I can, believe me. I'll give you my number in the city. Call me at any time. Collect if you need to.
I'm sure that won't be necessary. Clay reached out and took my hand, very gently, the way he'd been taught.
I'm just grateful you're here, Miranda. I'm just grateful Izzy's got someone like you around at last, a proper female influence, someone steady and sensible.
Thank you, I said dryly. Clay leaned forward and pressed my hand hard and kissed my cheek, cutting me off. He smelled of sunshine and perspiration, and his cheek, brushing mine, was hot and damp.
Just keep her busy, all right, he said. For God's sake, just keep her away from that Vargas.
15. Isabel drove home from the monk's house at a crawl, because she'd drunk so much gin and tonic over bridge, and the road, I think, was playing tricks on her. Overhead, the sky was gray and troubled, and a few fat drops of rain smacked against the windshield. Isabel switched the wipers on and off and peered up to check the state of the clouds.
"Peaches, darling," she said. "Do you know what I hate most about the island and everybody in it? Except you, I suppose."
"What's that?"
"Nobody ever says what they really mean. There is this vast fabric of tender little lies, and all the important things are unspoken, boiling there underneath. We only bother telling the truth when it's too small to count."
"I don't think that's true at all.
You haven't been here long enough. It's like a sport. It's the only real sport they know, and because I love sports, I play them at their game, but I hate it. If I had my horses now..."
"Why don't you?"
"There isn't room. Poor dears, they're on Long Island, getting fat."
She paused to negotiate a sharp curve, surging and slowing the Plymouth as if she couldn't decide her approach. She was a wholly different driver when drunk, I thought. And as I watched the bony grip of her hands on the wheel, fighting the turn, I wondered if I should offer to take over. Before I could work up the nerve, she straightened out the car and said,
"Don't you ever miss Foxcroft?"
I turned my head to stare out the window at the meadow passing by, the occasional driveway marked by stone pillars. The air was growing purple with some impending downpour, and I felt its approach in my gut.
"I haven't been gone long enough." "I do. When I was there, I couldn't wait to leave. All those books and rules and studying. But now I think at least there was something new every day. Here, everything's the same damned summer, over and over, the same day, the same people, the same small talk, the same small sports and parlor games and lies, of course. There's no escape."
"It's only a few months. Sometimes it's nice to spend a few months doing nothing."
"But then in September we go back to the city and do nothing there. What hope is there? Tell me, Miranda, I really want to know."
I turned to stare at her sharp profile, and for the first time I noticed a tiny bump along the bridge of her nose, as if she'd broken it some time ago. "You might have gone to college," I said. "That's just putting off the inevitable. Besides, I'm not like you. Books bore me. All your Shakespeare and Dickens and old men like that. Marriage is going to bore me even more." She opened the window a few inches and tossed her spent cigarette into the draft. "My God, I should have been born 10 years earlier." "Why?" "Why, because of the war. I'd have trained as a nurse or a resistance agent. I'd have been splendid at that. I'd have made some use of myself, some purpose. It would have transformed me. I'd never have been the same. I would have had no tolerance at all for this." She waved her hand at the island. "I don't understand how everybody could come back from the war and just sit there with a gin and tonic and play bridge. God, what a drag. It's like they've all gone to sleep." "Because it wasn't an adventure, Isabel. It was hell. People died." "Oh, that's right. I'm sorry, your father." She paused respectfully. We had reached the Greyfriars Drive, and she began to slow in preparation for the turn. Another handful of raindrops smacked the windshield. The drive was bordered with giant, mature rhododendrons, transported at great cost from the mainland. Isabel had told me how much as we drove away this morning, so that you couldn't see the house until you rounded the last curve, so that you found yourself straining and straining as you approached your destination. Now Isabel drove even more slowly, a walking pace, while I checked the sky and the windshield and clenched the muscles of my abdomen. Isabel waited until she began the last turn before she continued. "Still, you'd think they couldn't stand all this shallow hypocrisy after what they'd been through, and yet they embrace it. They want it to stretch on into infinity, never changing, never deviating one square inch from the old, dull, habitual ways. Marrying suitable boys you don't really love, having children you don't really want. I tell you, I can't stand it any longer. I'm about to explode, Miranda, but nobody knows it yet. Nobody but you. Just watch, I'm going to..." Her sentence drifted off, as if she'd lost her train of thought. I looked up and followed her gaze, and at first I saw nothing amiss, nothing out of order. Greyfriars rambled before us in its immaculate, elegant way, not a window out of place, gray shingle meeting white trim and green lawn. The grass, the young trees, the rose bushes, the neatly fenced kitchen garden, the tall boxwoods guarding the swimming pool, all these features as tidy as money could make them. Only the gathering rhythm of the rain disturbed the expensive fisher tranquility. Then I noticed the front door, which was open, and the person leaning against the doorway smoking a cigarette attached to a long black holder. A woman wearing a magenta dress, a towering hairdo, and a large white flower pinned above her right ear. "My God, who's that?" I asked. Isabel switched off the ignition and rested her arms on the top of the steering wheel. A prolonged rumble of thunder shook the windows. The woman straightened from the doorway and beckoned us with her cigarette in its holder. In a voice of wonder, Isabel said, "It's my mother." 16. "Call me Abigail," the Countess said, as I stumbled over her foreign title, which I couldn't quite remember. "Everybody else does, even my children." "Do they really? Just watch." She turned to Isabel, who had hung behind me as we raced across the gravel and ascended the steps in the gathering deluge, and now rolled her eyes as her mother embraced her dripping body. "Hello, darling. You look as beautiful as ever, of course. Except you really must eat more. People who don't eat are simply boring, and it's far better to be fat than boring, believe me." "Hello, Abigail," Isabel said. "What a delightful surprise." Up close, the Countess was even more extraordinary than from across the driveway. There was nothing dainty about her. She was tall and broad-shouldered, and her dress of magenta silk billowed down her heavy bones to sweep the ground, interrupted only by a sash at her waist, which, somewhat contradicting her earlier injunction, was not fat but certainly sturdy. She wore several glittering necklaces, and her hair, swept up in a pompadour, had already turned silver, though her face was still smooth. I think it hardly needs saying that her lipstick was the same color as her dress, and that a glass of gin and tonic rested in her other hand, the one not occupied with cigarettes, bearing a neat half-crescent of said lipstick on its rim. When she turned, as she did now, leading us from the foyer and down the hall, she revealed a narrow, gathered cape of magenta silk that drifted from the swooping neck of her gown to form a train behind her.
"I've taken the liberty of reserving a table at the club for dinner," she said over her shoulder. "But that's not for ages, so I've ordered tea on the terrace."
I expected nothing less.
"I've taken my old room, of course, which doesn't seem to be occupied. Where has all the staff gone, darling? We used to have 3 times as many housemaids running around. I had to shout for help, and I dislike shouting. It's barbaric."
"Housemaids don't grow on trees anymore, Abigail," Isabel said, walking past her mother to burst through the doors to the terrace, where a table and chairs had been arranged under the shelter of the porch while the rain poured beyond. A newspaper and a jeweled cigarette case lay next to the tea tray, and Isabel snatched up the case and flipped it open.
"You can't imagine how much servants cost, especially on the island."
"In France, they're dirt cheap. Everything's dirt cheap. You ought to move there with me, as I've told you 1,000 times.
Isabel lit her cigarette and turned.
"My French is terrible, Abigail."
The Countess snorted and turned to me.
"Tell me about yourself, dear. You're Francine's daughter, of course. Lovely Francine. I couldn't ask for a better wife for Hugh."
"She's a dear," Isabel said.
The Countess waved her hand at Isabel.
"No, I want to hear from Miranda. You and me, we have a way of drowning out other women who aren't as self-absorbed. And Miranda's not self-absorbed, are you, darling?"
"She is," Isabel said, "just in a different way. But everybody's self-absorbed in his own way. Being charitable is just its own form of self-absorption."
"Quiet," thundered her mother, and Isabel plopped onto a wicker chair and gave me a droll look.
"I don't know what to say, actually," I said. "What do you want to know?"
"What do you like to do, child? What do you like to read?"
"Shakespeare," supplied Isabel.
The Countess whipped around.
"Go inside, just go inside, or else remain absolutely, positively silent."
Isabel lifted her hand, zipped her lips, and stuck a cigarette between them. The Countess turned back to me.
"I apologize. I'm afraid I had very little to do with her upbringing, which was not my choice. Now it's too late.
And you're laughing at us. How despicable. Not that I blame you."
I collapsed on another of the wicker chairs.
"I'm sorry."
"No, don't apologize. You must never apologize unless absolutely necessary. Although if you must apologize, do it properly. You like Shakespeare, do you?"
"Among other things."
"What other things? Speak up, I can't hear you above all that deluge."
I raised my voice.
"Books. Art."
"Yes, but which books? Which art? This is terribly important. Do you prefer the Greeks or the Romans?"
"The Greeks."
"Middle Ages or Renaissance?"
"Renaissance. But I like some bits of the Middle Ages. The Plantagenets."
"Yes, brutal, but decisive, most of them. Truck full of sex appeal. I approve. Trollope or Dickens?"
"Trollope."
"Chinese art or Japanese?"
"Japanese."
"Verdi or Wagner?"
"Verdi. I can't bear Wagner's women. He doesn't understand them."
"What about Isolde?"
"She's only there to exalt Tristan."
"Brunhilde?"
"That's the exception. The only woman he actually makes wiser than the men, except she ends up dead like the others. At least the music is revolutionary."
The Countess turned to Isabel.
"There, you see? I'll bet I've found out more about her in 2 minutes than you've discovered in all those years at school."
Isabel gestured to her lips.
"You may speak."
"I was just going to say that I don't give a damn about any of those things."
The Countess frowned.
"Why are you wearing that awful suit?"
"This? Because we went to church this morning, Peaches and I."
"Peaches?"
That's her nickname. I gave it to her.
But why ever?
Because she's sweet and round and delicious, of course. Just look at her.
The Countess spun back to study me. She gave the business her whole attention, crossing her left arm under her breasts and propping her right elbow on the knuckles while she sucked thoughtfully on her cigarette. I tried to decide whether she was beautiful or not. Certainly her face had the symmetry of beauty, the shapely eyes, but really she was something else. Not handsome or pretty or attractive, something beyond description, so that she held your attention, your dumbstruck admiration without the slightest effort. Striking, that's the closest word. You could say she was striking. As she studied me studying her, she didn't give any sign of what she was thinking, or what conclusions she drew from whatever figure I presented to her, in my ragged hair and ill-tailored suit and sunburnt face. The cigarette languished and died. She plucked the stub from the holder and tossed it into the ashtray and said to her daughter, "Whatever she is, she's certainly not peaches. Are we absolutely certain you're mine, darling? It's impossible to believe I've borne a daughter with so little penetration." Isabel sprang from her chair and stalked to the French doors.
"I'm going to take a shower and change clothes. Are you coming, Peaches?"
"She's not answering to Peaches anymore," called back the Countess. "I forbid it."
Isabel didn't pause, and I rose and followed her, because I did need to bathe and change before dinner. There was no question of that. As I passed the Countess, she took me gently by the elbow.
"Before dinner," she whispered, "we've got to talk."
17.
"Don't do it," said Isabel. "Don't let her pounce on you. She will, you know. She's a terrible pouncer."
Isabel made claws with her hands as she paced across my bedroom floor in her bathrobe, smoking fiercely.
"Why not? I like her."
"Oh, everybody adores Abigail. That's how she does it. Look."
She stopped and spun to me.
"I need you to do me a favor, Peaches, a really big favor."
"A favor? What kind of favor? Don't I have to get dressed for dinner?" She glanced at her wristwatch.
"You've got an hour. I need you to go into the village. Quick, quick. It's only a mile. You've got to go to the harbor and deliver a little message for me."
"Can't you do it yourself?"
"No, stupid child. I can't do it myself. She's watching me."
Isabel pointed her finger straight down to the rug and the floorboards beneath, presumably in the direction of her mother. I was curled up on the window seat in my own bathrobe, my knees pulled up to my chin, my arms wrapped around my legs, still damp from bathing. As soon as I'd emerged from the bathroom, Isabel yanked me down the hall to my room and closed the door and began her pacing, and I contracted into this little ball in which I now found myself, like one of those insects. If I could have grown a shell, I would have, because Isabel's skin positively radiated waves of reckless, crackling electromagnetic energy, and I knew they meant trouble for yours truly. I turned my head and glanced out the window, where the Fleet Rock Lighthouse perched atop the water, washed in some kind of unearthly light as the rain sheeted away to the east.
"Yes, that's right," Isabel whispered.
"What's right?"
She darted forward and knelt before me, clutching my knees. "Joseph, I need you to give him a message." "Oh, Isabel, please, Peaches, darling Peaches, you know why she's here, don't you? She's my chaperone."
"Of course she is. She's your mother, isn't she?" Isabel's fingers dig into my skin.
"Listen to me. She hates Joseph. She hates all of them, the Vargases."
"Surely she doesn't hate them."
"Oh, she does, she does. It's why they divorced. Don't you know that?"
"One of the reasons, anyway. She's the worst kind of snob, the old money kind, and she hated seeing me play with Joseph when I was little because he's not the right sort, is he? A lobsterman's son. So when Daddy went away one summer, just before the war, she forbade me to play with him, forbade Joseph to come here. And when Daddy came home and found out, he absolutely blew up. And that's when she left him. And I know that's why she's here now. I know it."
"But that's ridiculous." "Oh, it isn't. Believe me. You have no idea, Peaches. No idea what bigots they are. She tried to get me to leave with her, but I wouldn't. I put my foot down. I wasn't going to give him up.
I released my arms from around my legs, forcing her hands away. She rose quickly and stepped back, but her wide, excited eyes didn't leave my face.
The thing is, I said, aren't you engaged to marry someone else?
It's not that, Peaches. It's the principle. I'm taking a stand, that's all.
She stuck her hand in the pocket of her bathrobe and brought out a piece of folded paper.
Just give him that, all right? He's down in the harbor right now, waiting for his mother to come out of church so he can take her home in the boat.
I looked down at the paper in her shaking hand.
Can't you just telephone him?
Abigail will overhear. She'll pick up the extension in the library.
Then deliver the note yourself.
She'll see me leaving. She'll see me headed for the harbor and stop me.
So what? You're all grown up. You can take a stand, like you said.
She'll find a way to punish me for it. Believe me, she's marvelously subtle, our Abigail. She'll say something to the monks.
Well, shouldn't she? If you're running around behind Clay's back?
Isabel's arm dropped.
Why, Miranda Schuyler, what a prig you are. You're no better than she is, aren't you? Girls should be locked up and spied on. It's for their own good, gracious me. God forbid the precious flower should speak to a boy she isn't married to, especially if he's some dirty Catholic boy.
I snatched the paper from her hand.
All right, just this once. But I don't like it, Isabel, not one bit. Not because he's a lobsterman, but because it's sneaky. It's dishonest.
I know, I'm terrible. She enfolded me in an enormous embrace.
You're such a darling for putting up with me. I can't tell you how grateful I am.
I stared over her shoulder at the pastel wall, the framed watercolor exactly above the bed on the right, and the matching watercolor above the one to the left. Her cigarette still burned from between her fingers, perilously close to the pale pink fluff of my bathrobe. The scent made me sick. Or maybe it was something else. Maybe I was already sick.
Just this once, I said.
Isabel pulled back and held me by the shoulders.
Just this once, she promised,
in a voice so sincere I knew it was a lie. 18. I found Joseph right away, reading a book from a puddle of sunshine on the bow deck of a sailboat. The same sailboat, I imagined, he'd taken about the island earlier that afternoon. I said his name and he scrambled upright, brushing his hair with his hand.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to startle you.
Not at all.
He glanced over my shoulder, across the street fronting the harbor.
What are you doing here? Don't you have dinner at the club or something?
Not for another hour. I had all these words, all these clever things I was going to say to him. I'd worked out my lines as I walked down West Cliff Road toward the harbor, jumping over the pockets of mud and water left behind by the squalls, and now I couldn't remember a single one. So I just pulled Isabel's note from the pocket of my cardigan and said, "Here, this is for you." He reached forward and took it.
"What's this?"
"From Isabel." He glanced up at me.
"From Izzy? What's it about?"
I shrugged. How should I know? She asked me to bring it to you. Her mother just arrived and she couldn't get away herself.
I see.
He still held the book in his left hand, folded over his thumb to mark his place. From this angle I couldn't see the title, and I didn't want to act as if I were curious. He was frowning at me, and I tried not to frown back, but the intent quality of his gaze started the blood to rise up my throat and into my cheeks. I shoved my hands in my pockets and started to turn.
"Well, goodbye, then," I said.
"Wait. I mean, does she want some kind of reply?"
"She didn't say."
"So hold on a minute."
He scrambled down from the bow and set down the book. I glanced at the cover and saw it was a handbook of practical shipbuilding. I hadn't lied to him. I really didn't know what Isabel wrote to him. I told myself I was just being honorable and decent, not reading other people's private messages. But the truth was, I didn't want to know. Had no desire to see the words inscribed on that page in Isabel's dashing handwriting. Even now I waited miserably as Joseph read the note,
As he stood there in the middle of the sailboat, perfectly balanced against the gentle lapping of the water, holding Isabel's sentences between his fingers. Instead of looking at his face, I stared with fascination at his neck and the intersection of his white collar and tanned skin. He swallowed briefly, and his Adam's apple slid up and down. "All right," he muttered. "All right."
"Can I go now?" I asked. "I've got to walk back to Greyfriars so I can change for dinner."
"I can drop you off on my way back to the lighthouse. Mama's coming out of church any minute."
"No, thanks. I'll walk."
"Are you headed to the club to eat?"
"Yes."
"When will you be back?"
"I don't know, 10 o'clock, maybe."
Joseph folded up the note and stuck it in the pocket of his trousers. His Sunday trousers, I supposed, tan and neatly creased, topped by a white shirt and starched collar and no tie. The kind of clothes you wore to take your mother to afternoon mass, even if you weren't going inside the church yourself, but lying back in the sunshine to read about shipbuilding and to intercept clandestine letters from your lady friend.
"Tell her it's all right with me," he said. "If you don't mind, that is."
"What's all right?"
He lifted his chin and looked out across the harbor, toward the dark line of the Connecticut shore on the western horizon. His eyes squinted, and his face caught the full sunshine of late afternoon.
"What she said in the note," he said, and looked at me. "You'll tell her that?"
"Sure." I turned away. "Have a nice evening."
"Miranda, wait. Is everything okay?"
"Sure it is."
"You look frosted. Are you sore at me?"
"I'm not sore."
"It's no trouble, is it?"
"No trouble at all. Enjoy your book. It's one of my favorites."
"Thanks, I will."
He glanced at the cover and grinned.
"One of your favorites, huh?"
"To each his own."
"Kind of an obsession, I guess. You've got your Shakespeare and your imagination. I've got the sea."
The unexpected warmth in his voice held me there on the dock, not moving, while the sun struck my back. The rains had cleared the atmosphere, had cleared the air of haze and heat. A breeze touched my hair. I heard him say my name, like a question.
"I'm sorry, I've really got to get going, or they'll wonder where I am."
"You're sure I can't take you back?"
I thought, I won't turn.
Anyway, I knew how he looked, standing there in his slim little sailboat, 1 foot braced on the side, wearing his good Sunday clothes. I wondered why he didn't go to afternoon mass with his mother, and waited instead on his sailboat studying shipbuilding. As I wondered this, I noticed a delicate black-clad woman making her way down Hemlock Street from the direction of the white church on the corner, and I pinned my gaze in fascination upon her figure. She wore something on her head, a hat that was not quite a hat, and a black veil that trembled in the breeze, as if she'd come from a funeral.
"That's Mama," said Joseph. "You're sure? I can have you home in a jiffy. The wind's just right."
"No, thank you."
I started back down the dock, moving quickly so I wouldn't be obliged to stop and speak to Mrs. Vargas. She seemed to have the same reluctance. She slowed her pace a tiny degree, so I was stepping off the dock in the opposite direction, while she was still a dozen yards away. I waved nonetheless, to be polite. She stared at me and nodded, and I thought her face was a little like Queen Victoria's, only not as plump, round and dour, hung with some pious, deep-felt grief. 19. We went to dinner and came home a little drunk. Naturally, the Countess's arrival at the club had caused the kind of excitement ordinarily reserved for foxes on the fairway, or lobster thermidor on the menu, and everybody came up to greet her, a blur of faces and names made fuzzier by all those bottles of vintage champagne the Countess kept ordering to toast them. So we were drunk, as I said, deliberately on my part, and Isabel made a great show of going to bed, but I wasn't fooled. I sat awake reading until I heard the infinitesimal creak of her door, the faint disturbance of the back staircase, and I laid aside my book and went to the window. Of course, there was nothing but shadows except for the regular sweep of the Fleet Rock lighthouse. But during one of those brief flights of light, I thought I saw a boat moored at the end of the Fisher Dock, and I thought I saw two people embracing on the bench near the water's edge. But it might have been a trick of my eyesight.
seeing the thing it expected to see. The mind's funny that way. In any case, I couldn't say for certain, and I rose from the window because I didn't really want to know. I didn't want to know the answer. 1969. Miranda Thomas. 1.